Toxin by Robin Cook. Continued. Cassette 7, Side 1. Let's test the audio system, Tracy suggested. I want to make sure it's working as well as it did last night in Lee's garage. Good idea, Kim said. You hop in your car and drive down to the corner. That should be just about right. Lee said it would work up to 200 yards. Where will you be? Tracy asked. I'll move around inside the house, Kim said. I'll even try going down into the basement. Tracy nodded and went down to the hall closet. She got out her coat, then called back up the stairs. Don't forget to put in your earphone, too. I already have it in, Kim yelled. Tracy went out into the crisp morning. A wind had come up during the night, blowing the storm clouds to the east. In their place was pale blue sky. Tracy got into her car, started it, and drove to the corner as they'd discussed. She pulled to the side of the road and turned off the engine. Next, she opened her driver's side window and put a makeshift antenna on the roof of her car. Inside the car, Tracy slipped on a pair of stereo earphones that were attached to an old-style reel-to-reel tape recorder. The tape recorder was wired to an amplifier, which in turn was connected to a transformer sitting on top of a freestanding car battery. A red light on the front panel of the amplifier illuminated when Tracy turned the unit on. She heard some brief static in her earphones, but it cleared quickly. On top of the amplifier was a microphone. Tracy picked it up. After glancing outside her car to make sure none of her neighbors were watching, she spoke into the microphone. Kim, can you hear me? She asked. Kim's voice came back so loud, Tracy winced. I can hear you like you were standing right next to me, he said. Tracy quickly turned down the volume and pressed the start button on the tape recorder. How's your volume? Tracy asked. You are much too loud on this end. It's fine, Kim said. Where are you? Tracy asked. I'm in the back part of the basement, Kim said. If it works here, I'm pretty sure it's going to work any place. It is surprisingly clear, Tracy admitted. Well, come on back, Kim said. Let's get this show on the road. 10-4, Tracy said. She had no idea what the expression meant, but had heard it in lots of movies and TV shows. She took off the headphones and stopped the tape. She rewound it and then played it. She was pleased that both sides of the conversation came through perfectly clear. By the time Tracy got back to the house, Kim had everything they intended to take waiting by the front door. They'd packed lunches and filled thermos bottles, banking on Kim being hired on the spot. They also had a blanket and extra sweaters for Tracy. Kim was sure it would be cold sitting in the car all day. They stowed everything in the back seat. Kim climbed in the back too, since the front passenger seat was taken up by the electronic equipment. Tracy slid behind the wheel and was about to start the car when she thought of something else. Where's your gun? She asked. It's upstairs in the guest room, Kim said. I think you should have it, Tracy said. I don't want to carry a gun in the slaughterhouse, Kim said. Why not? Tracy asked. God forbid, what if you have to face that creep with the knife again? Kim considered the suggestion. There were reasons against taking it. First, Kim was afraid the gun might somehow be discovered. Second, he'd never once fired it and didn't know if he could actually shoot someone. But then he remembered the panic he'd felt when he'd been chased by the man with the knife and how he'd wished he'd had some kind of weapon. All right, Kim said. He opened the door, took Tracy's keys, and returned to the house. A few minutes later, he climbed back into the car and handed the keys to Tracy. Tracy started the car and was about to back up. Wait a sec, Kim said. There's something else. Tracy turned the ignition key. The engine coughed and died. With a confused expression, she faced around at Kim. What now? She asked. Kim was staring up at the house. I was just thinking about that creep being in my house when we arrived last night, Kim said. I don't want to be surprised like that again. It's not entirely inconceivable that they could trace me here. What do you propose? Tracy asked with a shudder. Are any of your neighbors particularly nosy? Kim asked. These houses are all pretty close together. There's Mrs. English across the street, Tracy said. She's an elderly widow who, I swear, must spend the whole day looking out the window. That's a start, Kim said. Let's ask her to keep an eye out until we get back. Would you mind? Not at all, Tracy said. But that's not enough, Kim said. We got to have backups. It's got to be 100% sure. How many doors into the house? Just the usual front door and back door, Tracy said. What about the basement? Kim asked. The only way into the basement is through the house, Tracy said. The guy last night came through the back sliders, Kim said, while thinking out loud. This house has no sliders, Tracy said. Good. He got out of the car. Tracy did the same. Why not do something to the doors so we'd know if they'd been opened, Tracy suggested. I mean, for someone to get in, they'd have to break a window or go through one of the doors. When we get back, we can check. That's a good idea, Kim said. But then what would we do? Well, we sure as hell won't go in the house, Tracy said. Where would we go? Kim asked. We wouldn't want to be followed. Tracy shrugged. A motel, I guess? I know what we'll do, Kim said. On the way out to Higgins and Hancock, we'll stop by the bank. We'll pull out our savings as a fallback. If we're really worried about being followed, credit cards aren't the best idea. Wow, you really are thinking ahead, Tracy said. In that case, we might as well grab our passports, too. Listen, I'm being serious, Kim complained. So am I, Tracy said. If it gets to the point that we're that worried, I want the option of going far away. Fair enough, Kim said. Let's do it. It took them a half hour to do everything they had in mind around the house, and another half hour to stop at the bank. They used separate tellers to speed things up, but it didn't work. Kim's teller had been nonplussed by his appearance and had to go back to a manager to get the signature authenticated. I feel a little like a bank robber, Tracy said as they walked out to the car. I've never carried this much cash. I was afraid they weren't going to give me my money, Kim said. Maybe I've overdone it a little with this disguise. The fact that they didn't recognize you is the important point, Tracy said. It was mid-morning by the time they got on the freeway en route to Higgins and Hancock. The day that had started out so clear was already becoming veiled with high cirrus clouds. Midwestern winter weather rarely saw long periods of sunlight. What did you say to Mrs. English? Kim asked from the back seat. I didn't have to say much, Tracy said. She was delighted with the task. It's nasty to say, but I think we've given her life new meaning. When did you say you'd be back? Kim asked. I didn't, Tracy said. Let's review our high school Spanish, Kim said out of the blue. Surprised at this suggestion, Tracy glanced at Kim's reflection in the rearview mirror. In the last 24 hours, she couldn't tell when he was kidding and when he was being serious. I want to try to speak with a Spanish accent, Kim explained. Marcia said that a lot of the slaughterhouse workers are Hispanic, mostly Mexican. For the next few minutes, they counted in Spanish and constructed simple sentences. Neither could remember much vocabulary. They soon fell silent. Let me ask you something, Tracy said after they'd driven for a few miles without conversation. Shoot, Kim said. If all goes well, Tracy said, and we succeed in getting Kelly Anderson to cover the story and make it a big expose, what would you hope would happen? I'd like to see no market for the 25 billion pounds of ground meat produced each year, Kim said. And then what? Tracy asked. Well, Kim said while he put his thoughts in order, I'd want the public to demand that meat and poultry inspection, plus farm animal feed approval, be taken away from the USDA. It would be better if it were given to the FDA, which doesn't have a conflict of interest. Or better still, I'd like to see the system privatized so that there'd be a true competitive incentive for finding and eliminating contamination. You don't put much stock in this new meat irradiation movement, Tracy asked. Hell no, Kim said. That's just the industry's way of copping out. Allowing meat irradiation is just an invitation for the industry to allow that much more contamination to get in during processing, in the hopes it will all be killed with the gamma rays at the end. You'll notice, even with irradiation, the industry insists the onus is on the consumers to handle and cook the meat in a way the industry considers proper. That was Kathleen Morgan's position as well, Tracy said. It should be any thinking person's position, Kim said. We've got to get the media to make people understand that contamination must not be tolerated, even if it means the product will cost a little more. This is all a very tall order, Tracy commented. Hey, we might as well aim high, Kim said. And it's not impossible. After all, meat and poultry weren't always contaminated. It's a relatively recent phenomenon. In the distance, stockyards came into view. Consistent with its being a work day, herds of cattle could be seen milling about the muddy enclosure. It's kind of sad, Tracy said, looking out over the sea of animals. It's like they're all facing the death penalty. Tracy turned into the Higgins and Hancock parking lot. In contrast with their visit the previous morning, it was mostly full. A large proportion of the vehicles were aged pickup trucks. How about dropping me off near the front entrance, Kim said. Then I suggest you drive over to the end of the building. You won't be so noticeable there, and the entire plant will be well within 200 yards. Tracy pulled over to the curb. She and Kim looked at the building. The record room window that Kim had broken was unboarded, and its missing glass and mullions were apparent. Standing in the flower bed in front of the window was a man in overalls and a red plaid shirt, taking measurements. "I feel like I should offer to help," Kim said. "Don't be silly," Tracy said. The front door opened. Tracy and Kim instinctively slid down low in their seats. Two men came out of the front door, engrossed in conversation. Then the pair walked away. The plant was obviously in operation. Tracy and Kim straightened up. They looked at each other and smiled nervously. "We're acting like a couple of teenagers preparing to pull off a prank," Kim said. "Maybe we should talk this over some more," Tracy said. "Time for talk is over," Kim said. He leaned toward Tracy and gave her a kiss. It was the first time they'd kissed for longer time than either cared to remember. "Wish me luck," Kim added. "I don't know why I agreed to all this," Tracy said. She looked out at the slaughterhouse with misgivings. "You agreed out of civic responsibility," Kim said with an impish smile. "Hell, if we can pull this off, we'll be saving a million times more lives than I could with a lifetime of surgery." "You know what I find the most amazing about all this?" Tracy said, looking back at Kim. "Within a couple of days, you've gone from a narcissist to an altruist, from one extreme to another. I used to be under the impression that personalities couldn't change." "I'll let you psychologists worry about that," Kim said as he opened the car door. "Be careful," Tracy admonished. "I will," Kim said. He climbed out of the car, but then leaned back inside. "Remember, I'm only going to put my earphone in my ear on rare occasions. For the most part, this is going to be a one-way conversation." "I know," Tracy said. "Good luck." "Thanks," Kim said. "See ya." He waved goodbye. Tracy watched Kim saunter toward the door, in character with his outrageous disguise. Despite her apprehensions, she had to smile. He had the carefree, brazen look of a punk rock drifter. With the car back in gear, Tracy drove down to the end of the plant, as Kim had suggested, and parked behind a van. After rolling down the window, she put the antenna on top of the car. With the stereo headphones in place, she turned on the amplifier. After the experience that morning with the volume, she had the dial all the way down. Carefully, she turned it up. When she did, she immediately heard Kim's voice with an overdone Spanish accent. "I need a job. Any job," Kim was saying, drawing out his vowels. "I'm flat broke. I heard in town you were hiring." Tracy hit the start button on the tape recorder, then tried to make herself comfortable. Kim had been both impressed and encouraged by the speed with which he'd been escorted into the office of the kill floor supervisor. His name was Jed Street. He was a nondescript man with a slight paunch bulging his long white blood-stained coat. On the corner of his desk was a yellow plastic construction helmet. In front of him was a large stack of cattle purchases receipts. Jed had looked quizzically at Kim when Kim had first come through the door, but after a few moments, he'd seemingly accepted Kim's appearance and made no mention of it whatsoever.
"Have you ever worked in a slaughterhouse before?" Jed asked.
He rocked back in his desk chair and played with a pencil with both hands.
"No," Kim said casually, "but there's always the first time."
"Do you have a social security number?" Jed asked.
"Nope," Kim said. "I was told I didn't need one."
"What's your name?" Jed asked.
"Jose," Kim said. "Jose Ramirez."
"Where are you from?"
"Brownsville, Texas," Kim said, with more of a southern drawl than a Spanish accent.
"Yeah, and I'm from Paris, France," Jed said, seemingly oblivious to Kim's verbal faux pas.
He rocked forward.
"Look, this is hard, sloppy work. Are you ready for that?"
"I'm ready for anything," Kim said.
"Do you have a green card?" Jed asked.
"Nope."
"When are you willing to start?"
"Hey, I'm ready to start right now," Kim said. "I haven't eaten anything for a day and a half."
"That's probably a good thing," Jed said, "considering you've never been working in a slaughterhouse before. I'm going to have you start out sweeping the kill room floor. It's $5 an hour, cash, with no social security card. That's the best I can do."
"Sounds good," Kim said.
"One other thing," Jed said. "If you want to work, you got to work the 3 to 11 cleanup shift, too, but just for tonight. One of the guys called in sick. What do you say?"
"I say okay," Kim responded. Good, Jed said. He got to his feet. Let's get you outfitted.
You mean I have to change clothes? Kim asked anxiously. He could feel the gun pressing up against his thigh and the audio system's battery packs pressing against his chest.
Nah, Jed said. You only need a white coat, boots, hard hat, gloves, and a broom. The only thing you have to change are your shoes to get the boots on.
Kim followed Jed out of the supervisor's office and along the back corridor. They went into one of the storerooms Kim had looked into Saturday night. Kim got everything Jed had mentioned except the broom. For the boots, he had to settle for 11s. They were out of 10 1/2s. They were yellow rubber and came to mid-calf. They weren't new and didn't smell good. Jed gave Kim a combination lock and took him to the locker room off the lunchroom. He waited while Kim changed into the boots and stored his shoes. Once Kim had on the hard hat, the yellow gauntlet-length gloves, and the white coat, he looked like he belonged.
That's quite a cut you got on your nose, Jed commented. What happened?
A glass storm door broke, Kim said evasively.
Sorry to hear that, Jed said. Well, you ready for the plunge?
I guess, Kim said. Jed led Kim out through the lunchroom and up the half flight of stairs to the fire door. There he paused and waited for Kim to catch up. He took something out of his pocket and extended his hand to Kim.
I almost forgot these buggers, Jed said.
He dropped two small weightless objects into Kim's waiting palm.
What are these? Kim asked.
Earplugs, Jed said. There's a lot of noise out on the kill floor from the overhead rails and the power skinners and saws.
Kim examined one of the small, cone-shaped, sponge rubber-like earplugs. They, too, were yellow.
Listen, Jed said. Your job is to move around the floor and push the shit on the floor into the grates.
Shit? Kim asked.
Yeah, Jed said. You have a problem with that?
Real shit?
Well, a mixture of cow shit, barf, and gore, Jed said. Whatever falls down from the line. This isn't a tea party. And by the way, watch out for the moving carcasses suspended from the rails. And, of course, watch out for the slippery floor. Falling down is no picnic. Jed laughed.
Kim nodded and swallowed. He was really going to have to steel himself for the gruesome aspects of this job. Jed checked his watch.
It's less than an hour before we stop the line for the lunch break, he said. But no matter. It'll give you a chance to get acclimated. Any questions?
Kim shook his head.
If you do, Jed said, you know where my office is.
Right, Kim said. It seemed Jed was waiting for an answer.
Aren't you gonna put in those earplugs? Jed said.
Oh, yeah, Kim said. I forgot. Kim pushed the little spongy plugs into his ears and gave a thumbs-up sign to Jed. Jed threw open the door. Even with the earplugs, Kim was initially bowled over by the cacophony of noise that exploded into the stairwell. Kim followed Jed out onto the kill floor. It was a far different place than it had been on Saturday night. Kim thought he'd prepared himself for the experience awaiting him, but he hadn't. Instantly, he turned green at the sight of the overhead conveyor carrying the suspended, hot, 1,000-plus-pound carcasses, combined with the whine of all the power machinery and the horrid smell. The thick, warm air was laden with the stench of raw flesh, blood, and fresh feces. Kim was equally overwhelmed by the visual impact of the spectacle. The powerful roof air conditioners, vainly struggling to keep the room temperature down, caused the 50 or so skinned dead animals currently in Kim's line of sight to steam. Hundreds of workers in blood-spattered white coats were standing on the raised metal grate catwalks, elbow to elbow, laboring on the carcasses as they streaked by. Power lines draped about the space in a bewildering fashion, like pieces of a huge spiderweb. It was a surreal, Dante-esque image of the inferno, a hell on earth. Jed tapped Kim on the shoulder and pointed at the floor. Kim's eyes lowered. The kill floor was a literal sea of blood, pieces of internal organs, vomitus, and watery cow diarrhea. Jed tapped Kim again. Kim looked up. Jed was about to hand him a broom when he saw the color of Kim's face, and that Kim's cheeks were involuntarily billowing outward. Jed took a cautionary step backward while hastily pointing off to the side. Kim retched but managed to slap a hand to his face. He followed Jed's pointing finger and saw a door with a crudely painted sign that read, Gents. Kim made a beeline for the bathroom. He yanked open the door and dashed to the sink, Leaning forward on the cold porcelain, he convulsively vomited up the breakfast he'd shared with Tracy that morning. When the retching finally stopped, he rinsed out the sink and raised his head to look at himself in the cracked, dirty mirror. He was paler than he'd ever remembered, emphasized by his reddened, congested eyes. Beads of perspiration rimmed his forehead. Supporting his torso against the sink, he fumbled with the earphone that he had coiled beneath his shirt. With trembling fingers, he plucked out one of the earplugs Jed had given him and pushed in the earphone.
"Tracy, are you there?" Kim questioned with a raspy voice. "I've got my earphone in. You can talk."
"What happened?" Tracy asked. "Was that you coughing?"
"It was more than coughing," Kim admitted. "I just lost my breakfast."
"You sound terrible," Tracy said. "Are you all right?"
"I'm not great," Kim admitted. "I'm embarrassed at my reaction. With all my medical training, I didn't think I'd react quite so viscerally. This place is, well, it's indescribable."
He looked around the room, which was the filthiest men's room he'd ever been in. The walls were covered with stains and smutty graffiti, mostly in Spanish. The tiled floor looked like it had never been mopped and was covered with a film of blood and other debris tracked in from the kill floor.
"You want to call it quits?" Tracy asked. "I can't say I'd mind."
"Not yet," Kim said. "But I'll tell you, I was only out on the kill floor for 20 seconds, and I think I've become an instant vegetarian." The sudden sound of a flushing toilet in one of the two stalls lining the side of the men's room made Kim jump. He'd not bothered to check if either of the toilets was occupied. He yanked out the earphone, tucked it and its wire back under his shirt, and turned to the sink to pretend he was washing. Behind him, he heard the stall door bang open. Kim worried what the stranger had heard, and for the moment he didn't look in the man's direction. In the mirror, he saw the man pass slowly behind him, studying him quizzically, and Kim's heart leaped up into his throat. It was the man who'd attacked him, first there at Higgins and Hancock, and then again in his own home. Slowly, Kim turned around. The man had proceeded to the door but hadn't opened it. He was still staring at Kim inscrutably. For an instant, Kim locked eyes with the stranger. Kim tried to smile as he pretended to look for paper towels. There was a dispenser, but its front was ripped away and its interior was empty. Kim hazarded another glance at the stranger. His enigmatic expression had not changed. Kim's right hand sought the comfort of the gun in his pocket. Seconds seemed like minutes to Kim. The man's cold, black, impenetrable eyes remained riveted on him. The man was like a statue. It took all of Kim's self-control not to say something to break the uncomfortable silence. To Kim's utter relief, the man suddenly broke off the confrontation, pushed open the door, and disappeared. Kim exhaled. He'd not even been aware that he'd been holding his breath. Bending his head down, he whispered into his concealed microphone.
"Good Lord, the knife-wielding madman was in one of the toilet stalls. I don't know what he heard. He stared at me but didn't say anything. Let's hope to hell he didn't recognize me."
After splashing some cold water on his face and replacing the earplug, Kim took a deep breath and pushed out through the bathroom door to return to the kill floor. He tried to breathe shallowly through his mouth to avoid the smell. His legs felt a little rubbery. Just in case the stranger was waiting for him, he had a hand in his pocket, gripping the snub-nosed pistol. Jed was standing close by, obviously waiting for Kim. Kim looked for the stranger, and he thought he caught sight of him off to the side, just disappearing around the edge of a distant piece of machinery.
"You all right?" Jed shouted over the din.
Kim nodded and tried to smile. Jed gave him a wry smile in return and handed him the long-handled, stiff-bristled broom.
"You might have had more in your stomach than you thought," he said.
Then he patted Kim on the back before walking off. Kim swallowed and shuddered to stave off another wave of nausea. He put his head down to avoid looking at the line of headless, skinless carcasses moving rapidly in front of him on their way to the cooler. Grasping the broom in both hands, he tried to concentrate on pushing the offal that covered the floor toward one of the many grates.
"I don't know if you can hear me with all this noise," Kim said with his mouth close to the microphone. "Obviously, the guy with the knife works here, which, when I think about it, doesn't surprise me. I think I better locate him."
Kim ducked as one of the 1,000-plus-pound steaming carcasses brushed by him. By not looking where he was moving, he'd inadvertently gotten in the way of the overhead conveyor. Now his white coat had a bloodstain just like everyone else's in the vast room. Kim straightened up, and after judging the speed of the carcasses, stepped through the line. He was intent on following the route taken by the man who'd attacked him. "Obviously, I've been given the worst job in the place," Kim commented, hoping that Tracy could hear him despite the general racket. "I'm the lowest of the low, but at least it gives me the opportunity to move around. It's like an assembly line for all the other workers. They stay in the same place while the carcasses move." Kim moved around the monstrous piece of machinery he'd seen the stranger disappear behind. The floor in this area of the room was relatively clean. There was only a small amount of blood that had seeped beneath the equipment. To Kim's left was a wall. Kim continued forward. Ahead, in a darker area of the room where there were no ceiling fluorescent lights, he could see several men working. A new sound emerged from the general background noise. It was an intermittent percussive sound that made Kim think of the kind of air gun used in carpentry to shoot nails. Kim continued to sweep with his broom, although there was little debris on the floor. After another 20 feet and rounding another piece of equipment, he could see what part of the room he was in. "I've come to where the live animals enter the building," Kim said into his microphone. "They're funneled into single file. When the lead animal comes abreast of an elevated platform, a man presses what looks like a jackhammer against the top of its head. It sounds like a nail gun. It must shoot a bolt into their skulls because I can see brain tissue spatter out." Kim looked away for a moment. As a man who'd dedicated his life to saving lives, this unabated carnage made him feel weak. After a moment, he forced himself to look back. The cows immediately collapse onto a large rotating drum that throws them forward and upends them, Kim continued. Then a worker hooks them behind the Achilles tendon, and they are hoisted up onto the overhead conveyor. If and when we get mad cow disease in this country, killing the animals like this will not be a good idea. It's undoubtedly sending emboli of brain tissue throughout the cow's body, since the cow's hearts are still beating. Despite his revulsion about what he was witnessing, Kim forced himself to move forward. He now had an unobstructed view. "You know something?" Kim said. "These hapless steers somehow know what's coming. They must smell death in here. They're defecating all over each other as they come down the chute. That certainly can't help the contamination." Kim stopped in mid-sentence. To his right and only 20 feet away was the knife-wielding stranger. Instantly, he knew why the man favored knives. He was one of two people who stepped beneath the newly killed animal as it was hoisted up. With a deft flick of the wrist, he or his partner slit the throat of the animal and then jumped free of the 10-gallon shower of hot cow blood. The blood came in giant pulsating squirts as the animal's heart pumped out its life force. The blood then disappeared into a grate in the floor. In the next second, Kim's heart leaped in his chest. Already tense from seeing his attacker so close, he overreacted when someone tapped him on the shoulder. Before he could stop himself, he threw an arm up defensively. Luckily, it was Jed, and he didn't look happy. Kim's reaction had scared him as much as he had scared Kim.
"What the hell are you doing over here?" Jed shouted over the noise.
The repeated concussion of the high-pressure killing instrument sounded like an evil metronome.
"I'm just trying to get oriented," Kim yelled.
He shot a glance back at his attacker, but the man either hadn't seen Kim or didn't care about him. He'd stepped off to the side and was in the process of sharpening his knife with a grindstone while his partner took over the throat slitting. Kim could see the knife clearly. It was similar to the one the man had used when he'd attacked Kim.
"Hey, I'm talking to you," Jed yelled irritably.
He poked at Kim with an insistent finger.
"I want you to get your ass around to where they're eviscerating. That's where the shit is, and that's where I want you to be."
Kim nodded.
"Come on, I'll show you," Jed said.
He motioned for Kim to follow him. Kim cast one last look at his attacker, who was holding up the knife to inspect its razor edge. A flash of light glinted off the blade. He didn't look in Kim's direction. Kim shuddered and rushed after Jed. They soon came to the moving line of carcasses. Kim was impressed by Jed's nonchalance. When he ducked through, he actually pushed the bodies aside like clothes on a rack, rather than waiting for a moment to dart through an opening. Kim was reluctant to touch the hot bodies. He had to hesitate like a jumper waiting to enter a jump rope that was being rapidly whipped around by two friends.
"This is where I want you," Jed yelled when Kim caught up to him.
Jed made a sweeping motion with his hand.
"Here's where the dirty work is done, and this is where you and your broom should hang out. Understand?"
Kim nodded reluctantly while fighting against another wave of nausea. He was now in the area where the internal organs were being removed. Huge, snake-like coils of intestines were sloshing out of the suspended carcasses onto stainless steel tables, along with quivering masses of liver, grapefruit-sized kidneys, and friable strips of pancreas. Most of the intestines appeared to be tied off, but some weren't. Either they hadn't been tied or the tie had come loose. One way or the other, there were also a lot of cow feces on the tables and on the floor, mixing with the rivers of blood. Kim lowered the head of his broom to the floor and started pushing the slop toward one of the many grates. As he worked, he was reminded of the myth of Sisyphus and the cruel king's terrible fate. No sooner had Kim cleared an area of its filth than it became refouled with a fresh deluge of blood and offal. Kim's only solace was the fact that his disguise must have been adequate. He was relatively confident that the man with the knife had not recognized him. Kim tried his best to ignore the more grisly aspects of this ghostly workplace. Instead, he concentrated on his immediate task at hand. For the next step in his undercover investigation, he'd wait until the lunch break. Out the window, Shanahan could see a jumbo jet laboriously lumber down the runway and then ever so hesitantly lift its nose. Seemingly going much too slowly, it became airborne and headed off toward a distant destination. Shanahan was at gate 32 on Concourse B, waiting for the flight from Chicago. It had not been easy getting there. The people at security had tried to deny him access to the concourse without a ticket. Since he'd made specific plans to meet Lootman at the gate, Shanahan knew he had to get there. Unfortunately, no amount of arguing or cajoling had swayed the security people. To solve the dilemma, Shanahan had had to purchase a ticket on a flight he didn't intend to take. Shanahan and Derek had never met. To overcome that difficulty, Shanahan had described himself so that Derek might recognize him. But to make certain Derek would identify him, Shanahan had also said he'd carry a Bible. Derek had said he'd thought a Bible was a nice touch. He added that he'd be carrying a black briefcase. The door to the jetway for the Chicago flight opened and was secured by an agent. Almost immediately, the passengers began disembarking. Shanahan picked up the Bible and stood. He gazed at each passenger expectantly. The 10th person looked promising, although the individual's appearance was not anything like Shanahan had expected. The man was 30-ish, slender, blonde, and deeply tanned. He was dressed in a pinstriped business suit and carrying a black ostrich briefcase. Sunglasses were perched on top of his carefully coiffed head. The man halted just inside the terminal and swept the area with his blue eyes. Spotting Shanahan, he walked directly over.
"Mr. O'Brien?" Derek questioned. He had a slight English accent.
"Mr. Lootman," Shanahan said. He was taken aback.
From Derek's phone voice, he'd expected a dark, heavy-set, physically imposing individual. The man in front of him resembled an English aristocrat more than a hired killer.
"I trust you brought the money," Derek said.
"Of course," Shanahan said.
"Would you mind handing it over?" Derek said.
"Here in the terminal?" Shanahan questioned.
He looked over his shoulder nervously. Shanahan had hoped to discuss the money issue in the privacy of his car in the parking garage. He was supposed to try to negotiate down both the down payment and the fee.
"Either we're in business or not," Derek said. "It's best to find out immediately to avoid hard feelings."
Shanahan removed the envelope he had in his inner jacket pocket and gave it to Derek. It contained $5,000, half of the $10,000 the killer had demanded. There was no way Shanahan was going to try to bargain in public. To Shanahan's horror, Derek put down his briefcase, blithely tore open the envelope, and counted the money. Shanahan anxiously looked around. Although no one appeared to be paying them any attention, Shanahan was acutely uncomfortable.
"Excellent," Derek commented before pocketing the cash. "We're in business. What are the details you're supposed to provide me?"
"Could we at least start walking?"
Shanahan managed to say despite a dry throat. Derek's nonchalance was unnerving.
"Of course," Derek said.
He gestured down the concourse.
"Why don't we proceed to baggage claim?"
Thankful to at least be moving, Shanahan started out. Derek stayed abreast, treading lightly on crepe-soled loafers.
"You have checked baggage?" Shanahan asked.
It was something else he didn't expect.
"Of course," Derek said. "The airlines frown on firearms in the cabin. In my line of work, one has little choice."
They were walking along with a stream of other arriving passengers. To their left passed an equal number of people clutching tickets and hurrying in the opposite direction. There was no privacy.
"We have a car for you," Shanahan said.
"Excellent," Derek said. "But at the moment, I'm more interested in the identity of the quarry. What's the name?"
"Regis," Shanahan said.
"Dr. Kim Regis."
Once again, he scanned the faces around them. Thankfully, there were no signs of interest or recognition.
"Here's a recent photo," Shanahan said.
He handed the picture to Derek. It wasn't very good. It had been copied from a newspaper article.
"This is quite grainy," Derek said. "I'm going to need more information."
"I've put together a bio," Shanahan said.
He handed the paper to Derek.
"You'll notice it has a physical description of the man. There's also the year, model, and type of his car, along with the tag number. You have his address, but we have reason to believe he's not staying there at the moment."
"This is more like it," Derek said as he scanned the sheet.
"Yes, indeed, very complete."
"We believe Dr. Regis spent last night at his former wife's residence," Shanahan said. "She bailed him out of jail yesterday morning."
"Jail?" Derek questioned. "Sounds like the doctor has been misbehaving."
"That's an understatement as far as we're concerned," Shanahan said.
They reached the baggage carousel and pressed in among the other passengers. The baggage from Derek's flight was just beginning to appear.
"There's one thing that I think you ought to know," Shanahan said. "There was a botched attempt on the doctor's life last night."
"Thank you for your forthrightness," Derek said.
"That is indeed an important point. What you mean to say, of course, is that the man will be highly vigilant."
"Something like that," Shanahan said.
A shrill beeping sound made the tense Shanahan jump. It took him a moment to realize it was his pager. Surprised at being paged, since Bobby Bone knew where he was and what he was doing, Shanahan snapped the pager off his belt and glanced at the small LCD screen.
He was further confused because he didn't recognize the number.
"Would you mind if I used a phone?" Shanahan said.
He pointed to a bank of payphones lining a nearby wall.
"Not at all," Derek said.
He was contentedly studying the information sheet on Kim. Finding a few coins in his pocket en route to the phone, Shanahan quickly dialed the mysterious number. The phone was picked up on the first ring. It was Carlos.
"The doctor is here," Carlos said in an excited, forced whisper.
"What the hell are you talking about?" Shanahan asked.
"Here, at Higgins and Hancock," Carlos said, keeping his voice low. "I'm using the phone in the lunchroom. This has to be fast. The doctor is working here as a slop boy. He looks crazy, man."
"What are you talking about?" Shanahan asked.
"He looks weird," Carlos said. "He looks like an old rock singer. His hair's cut short, and what's left is blonde."
"You're joking," Shanahan said.
"No, man," Carlos insisted. "He's also got stitches on his face where I cut him. It's him. I know it is, although I had to look at him for a couple of minutes before I was sure. Then he came all the way around to my station and stood there for a couple of minutes until the boss came and dragged him away."
"What boss?" Shanahan asked.
"Jed Street," Carlos said.
"Did the doctor recognize you?" Shanahan asked.
"Sure, why not?" Carlos said. "He was staring at me. For a minute, I was thinking he might come after me, but he didn't. If he had, I would have done him in. You want me to do it anyway? I can get him while he's here."
"No," Shanahan shouted, losing control of himself for a moment.
He knew that if Carlos killed Kim in the middle of the day with 100 witnesses, it would be a disaster. Shanahan took a deep breath and then spoke quietly and slowly.
"Don't do anything. Pretend you don't recognize him. Just stay cool. I'll get word to you. Understand?"
"I want to do this guy," Carlos said. "I told you, I don't want the money."
"That's very generous of you," Shanahan said. "Of course, you were the one who screwed up to begin with. But that's not the point at the moment. I'll get word to you, okay?"
"Okay," Carlos said.
Shanahan hung up the phone. He kept his hand on the receiver while he looked over at Derek Lootman. This was a quandary. For the moment, he didn't know what to do. An unexpected tapping on the driver's side window made Tracy's heart skip a beat. During the time that she'd been parked at the end of the slaughterhouse, she'd seen occasional people coming and going from their vehicles, but no one had come near her car. Hastily, Tracy pulled off the stereo headphones and turned to look out the window. Standing next to the car was a grizzly man clad in soiled overalls and a dirty turtleneck. On his head was a baseball hat turned backwards. Glued to his lower lip was an unlit cigarette that bobbed up and down as he breathed through his open mouth. Tracy's first impulse was to start the car and drive away. That idea was abandoned when she remembered the antenna teetering on the roof. Feeling she had little choice, she cracked the window.
"I saw you from my truck," the man said. He pointed over his shoulder at a neighboring van.
"Oh, really?" Tracy responded anxiously. She didn't know what else to say. The man had a vivid scar that ran down the side of his face onto his neck.
"What you listening to?" the man asked.
"Not much," Tracy said. She looked over at the tape recorder. It was still rolling. "Just some music."
"I like country music," the man said. "You listening to country music?"
"No," Tracy said with a weak smile. "This is more new age. Actually, I'm waiting for my husband. He's working here."
"I've been doing some plumbing work here myself," the man said. "They got more drains and pipes here than any place in the county. Anyhow, I was wondering if you've got a light. I can't find my lighter no place."
"Sorry," Tracy said. "I wish I could help you, but I don't smoke, and I don't have any matches."
"Well, thanks anyway," the man said. "Sorry to bother you."
"No bother," Tracy said. The man walked away, and Tracy breathed a sigh of relief. She rolled up the window. The episode made her realize how tense she was. She'd been on edge from the moment Kim had disappeared inside, but her anxieties had skyrocketed ever since Kim's confrontation with the killer in the bathroom. The fact that she'd not been able to talk to Kim didn't help. She truly wanted to tell him to get out of there. It just wasn't worth it. After a furtive glance around to make sure no one else was watching her, Tracy slipped the stereo headphones back on and closed her eyes. The problem was, she had to concentrate to hear what Kim was saying. The general din inside the plant had forced her to turn the volume down quite low. Kim had moved all the way around the eviscerating area and now had a view of the whole slaughtering process. He could see the cows being killed, hoisted up, and their throats being slit. Next, they were skinned and decapitated, with the heads going off on a separate overhead conveyor system. After the evisceration, the carcasses were sawed in half lengthwise by a frightful saw far beyond the gruesome conceptions of Hollywood horror movie producers. Kim glanced at his watch to time the rapidity with which the wretched animals were killed. He was astonished. With his chin down on his chest, he spoke into his microphone.
"Let's hope Lee Cook can come up with an appropriate video system," he said. "It's going to be a snap to document Marsha's major point. She said the problem concerning contamination in the meat industry was in the slaughterhouse. She said it was simply profit over safety. I just timed the activity here. They're slaughtering the cattle at the unbelievable rate of 1 every 12 seconds. At that speed, there's no way to avoid gross contamination." "And talk about collusion between the USDA and the industry. It's even evident on this operational level. Up on the catwalks, there are a few inspectors. They stand out like black sheep. They wear red hard hats instead of yellow, and their white coats are comparatively clean. But they're doing more laughing and joking with the workers than inspecting. I mean, the inspecting is pure sham. Not only is the line moving too fast, these guys are hardly even looking at the carcasses as they whip by."
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.